on my book. So we know what engagements they've had, as we do with MPs. I mean, there was a great fuss over Keir Starmer's glasses, which aren't worth very much money, I don't think. But we knew about those. We knew about the football tickets, which he and other members of the government and MPs generally were securing from the Premier League at the time they were looking at a regulator. We know these things about MPs. We don't know what happens with the royal family in the same way, and we should do. The same rules should apply to them. As far as Andrew's concerned in the Middle East, he used his position as trade envoy for 10 years or more to engage with them for his own benefit, not for the benefit of this country, but for his own benefit. There's a list at the back of my new book of all the engagements he undertook over that period of time. And you'll find Bahrain and Oman and the Middle Eastern countries and countries, the stands, countries with dictators and unpleasant regimes, feature very, very large in his travel arrangements.
That was Norman Baker, the former Liberal Democrat Home Office Minister and author of And What Do You Do? What the Royal Family Don't Want You to Know. Norman, thank you for that. That's it from me for this week. Thank you so much for your company. Aisha Hazarika's here from 1 o'clock tomorrow. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. On the Times at One next week, it's Joe Coburn. But right now, get ready for Rosie Wright and Fee Glover. They're here next on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Jeremy, thank you. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
Coming up on our programme today, Vladimir Putin is morally responsible for Dawn Sturgis's poisoning with the Russian nerve agent Novichok. As the inquiry into her death reports back, we're going to talk to Mark Urban, who has covered the story right from the start. Diagnoses of mental illness and mental health conditions are rising sharply. The Health Secretary is reviewing why. We will discuss the cost to the economy. The world is glued to reports. The whole world is glued to reports of a raccoon that had a particularly big night. And a scientist is going to tell us why animals like getting drunk. There is no hyperbole in these headlines at all. And as 2025 draws to a close, what's your word of the year? Our big interview after 3:30 is with wordsmith personified Susie Dent.
But first, let's get the very latest news now with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, Rosie. Thank you. An inquiry into the death of Dawn Sturgis in the wake of the Salisbury poisoning has found failings by British authorities did not directly lead to her death. She died aged 44 after spraying herself with the leftover nerve agent Novichok, which two Russian spies used to try to kill former agent Sergei Skripal. The inquiry chair, Lord Hughes, says those spies are to blame.
The conduct of Petrov and Bosharov and their GRU superiors and those who authorised the mission up to and including, as I found, President Putin, that conduct was astonishingly reckless. And they, and only they, bear moral responsibility for it.
Lord Hughes says there was no medical help which would have saved Ms. Sturgis's life, and it wasn't reasonable to expect British authorities to prepare for such a plot. The UK has sanctioned Russia's GRU spy agency. The number of people in hospital in England with flu is at a record high for this time of year. 1,700 flu patients were in hospital beds every day on average in England last week, 56% higher than last year. Alongside this, the NHS is warning people with minor problems not to go to A&E. The president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Ian Higginson, told Times Radio the bigger problem is not enough beds or help in care outside of hospitals.
There are loads and loads of patients in our hospital beds who don't need to be there, and they can't go home either because the services aren't there to support them at home or because they can't get into residential facilities like care homes or nursing homes to help them recover. And these problems have been absolutely in plain sight for years and years, and yet our politicians have failed to act on it.
Reform UK has received what it's believed to be the biggest single donation from a living person. Former Boris Johnson donor Christopher Harbin's given £9 million. The government says an expert panel will examine how CCTV can be used in nurseries after multiple sexual offences in North London. Vincent Chan yesterday pled guilty to 26 child sex offences, including at a branch of Bright Horizons in West Hampstead, which is now closed. The company says it's commissioned an external review of its safeguarding. And in the Ashes, Joe Root has saved the day for England with his first Test century in Australia. His 135 not out on day one of the second Test means England ended the day 325 for nine. That's in part thanks to Root's successful partnership with Jofra Archer, who's 32 not out. Australia bowler Mitchell Starc praised Root afterwards.
Well, I think he scored a lot of 50s in Australia, and I'm sure he'd be relieved to get that 100, but he played fantastically well today and assessed the conditions, sucked up some pressure and got the result by the end of the day. So, yeah, he played fantastically well. And, today we've both got some runs and we get to call it even today.
Root and Archer will go back out to bat tomorrow at the Gabba in Brisbane. Australia are yet to bat and they hold a 1-0 advantage in the series. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Well, in fact, it is Fee Glover and Rosie Wright today. It's Thursday. Is it gloomy where you are? Is it raining? Is it chilly? Did you get a disappointing picture of a holly tree in your advent calendar today? I did. And if you're listening in Tunbridge Wells, are you aching for a nice hot bath? Well, we can't provide that, I'm afraid, but we do give you audio warmth. Not quite the same, but you know what I mean. It's a lovely show for you today. We're going to look to the skies to consider two new British satellites that have been sent up there. It's a UK success story. We might give it its own fanfare. Egypt would like the Rosetta Stone back. It's currently on display in the British Museum. It's a star item, but should it be? There are 50,000 objects from ancient Egypt in the museum. We're going to talk to our own display item, Ed Vasey, about that because he's chair of the Parthenon Project. We are also going to consider animals' morality and decision-making abilities after a raccoon was found face down on the floor of a liquor store toilet in Virginia after a night's binge drinking. Will he regret his behaviour, or like most of us, especially in our teenage years, will he live to fight another day and do it no differently at all? Rosie and I do give you permission to take a tiny, tiny break or multitask whilst listening to this radio programme to go and find the image of the raccoon, because it is just funny. It's funny because the raccoon is fine. He is completely recovered, but he is splayed out on all fours next to a toilet. And let's face it, we've probably all been there. After 3 o'clock, we're going to look at the report into the Salisbury poisonings and the death of Dawn Sturgis. And we're going to do that with Mark Urban, who's followed the story from the start and has interviewed the Skripals. And to many, it seemed incredible that Sergei Skripal and his daughter were living their quiet life in Wiltshire, using their own names. They were in the phone book. They were known to neighbours. They were so easy to find by Russian agents. After 3:30, Rosie, who's the guest?
The woman you need when you are searching around for that perfect word. Susie Dent, the lexicographer extraordinaire. You will know her, of course, from Countdown Corner. She's reigned there supreme. Ah, yes. For 30 years, over 30 years. So much we were able to chat about. The origins of new expressions, for example, you know, how did the Prime Minister get caught up in that sort of 6-7 primary school word craze? If it matters that teenagers have started skipping out words when they say they're going pub or going gym. And how, she says, she makes a real case, a pitch for how we should use more positives. So let's bring back shevelled rather than commenting on how dishevelled someone looks. It was a great fun conversation. I'm a little bit, I admitted this to Fia, I'm a little bit scared of words because I'm not very good at spelling. And to give you a sort of secret behind the scenes here, when we see a word coming up, I think I've got no idea how to say that. There are two rules, say it confidently and say it quickly. But Susie will make the case to celebrate words rather than hurry over.
Yeah, and just say them. I mean, there is nothing that our listeners like more than being able to correct us for some appalling pronunciation. So we're kind of doing a public service if we get some things wrong.
Exactly, to demonstrate to everyone else, or grammar. The one I fear of the messages that are coming in already, but the one I think really seems to be evaporating away is the difference between less and fewer, because I think fewer people can now define what the rule actually is.
So what's the rule that you're using to differentiate between
all
them?
All I know is that one is that you can count and one you can't. Yeah.
So fewer is the one that you can count and less is when it's just a more random volume of something,
okay.
I think. But there'll be someone out there who'll know better than us.
But all of those sort of very juicy rules about language, how you use it, the one that caused an awful lot of upset in the Wright household, because I am sure you've probably had debates around the table about how you're using words or not, or trying to get teenagers, particularly teenage girls, not to say like all the time, was the word literally, because the word literally had its definition changed so that it was not incorrect to say something was literally on fire when it wasn't. So quite the opposite of the meaning of the word. That
okay.
caused some scuffles
that's
in the Wright household.
That's very good to know. That's a real, in fact, I think you'll find kind of thing that you can tell people, isn't it? You know, the one that I really do hate is the overuse of surreal, because so many things are being described as surreal that aren't. If you can see them in reality, they're not surreal. It's as simple as that. And so that's my shout out loud at the television and the radio moment.
Words can have a real moment, can't they? Smorgasbord was very a la mode for about 30 minutes last week, and then we couldn't hear any more of it when we were talking about the budget. So
I've had enough of it.
Same. It had its moment in the sun and it's now gone.
Most read stories on the Times website so far this afternoon, please.
Number three, Putin ordered Sergei Skripal poisoning to show Russian power. A public inquiry into the death of Dawn Sturgis, who was exposed to Novichok, concluded that the Salisbury assassination attempt must have had senior approval. The second most story is new photos of Epstein Island offer a disturbing look inside. A dentist chair with masks around it, a blackboard with the words power and deception are among a new set of photographs and videos. And the most read piece on the Times website is something positive. England v Australia live score. Joe Root makes 100 runs at the Ashes 2025. Follow our Ashes scorecard and expert analysis live from Australia as Joe Root leads the charge for Ben Stokes' team against Steve Smith's side. You can read all of those articles at thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
We are 0333 003 2353 this afternoon, and we are Jane and Fee at times.radio. Off we go then with all of the day's news. It's 10 minutes past two. The government has launched an inquiry into why so many working age people, especially young people, are now out of the workforce with autism, ADHD or mental health conditions. Wes Streeting says he wants to understand whether these conditions are being overdiagnosed and what that means for the NHS and also for the benefit system. So let's talk to Alexa Knight, Director of Policy and Influence at the Mental Health Foundation. Alexa, a very good afternoon from us. Do you have any solid evidence that autism, ADHD or any mental health condition is being overdiagnosed?
Hi there, and thanks for having me. Well, it's interesting that the review is being reported into an inquiry into overdiagnosis, because actually that's not in the terms of reference at all. And there is no evidence that these things are being overdiagnosed. I should say that I'm not an expert in neurodivergency, but certainly from a mental health perspective, actually the opposite is true. We know that people are experiencing poorer mental health, and the likelihood is that it's still being underdiagnosed. But we really welcome this review. I mean, it's absolutely vital that we understand why levels of poor mental health are increasing, and we have a look at what can be done to prevent that and how people can move through the system and get support much more quickly.
So, Alexa, I think the huge point that we just need to tackle first off, though, is people's perception of diagnosis and overdiagnosis. Because when you say that there isn't any evidence that it's happening, I know that there'll be people listening to this afternoon shouting back at the radio saying, well, how can that be? You know, how can we be in a worse position now than we were, let's say, as people recovered from the effects of the Second World War, as people recovered from the effects of the Depression in the 1970s, the winter of discontent? You know, those kind of social pressures that have been on this nation before, which haven't resulted in such extraordinary numbers of people being out of the workforce because of what is happening with their mental health.
Yeah, so those are really important questions to ask, and hopefully the review will look at some of those things. I mean, it's very likely that it's a combination of all sorts of things that have happened over the last 10, 15 years. A lot of it may be to do with economic pressures. We know that poverty is one of the biggest drivers of poor mental health, and we've had a long period of austerity now where people have really felt the pinch of that. And, you know, young people growing up in poverty and then struggling as they try to transition into adulthood. On top of that, there's been huge changes socially. Lots of the old and trusted and reliable social connections that people used to have in communities have been broken. There's been underinvestment in society and in social structures. And then, of course, massive technological changes as well as changes in the way we work and the pressures on people. So all sorts of things are happening. It's really important we take a look at them properly.
Do you think that there is a difference, though, in what we think, I don't really want to use the word entitled, let's say what we think enables us not to go to work, though? Has that bar changed?
I think there's lots of misconceptions about mental health and work, and particularly benefits and the reasons why people are claiming benefits. I mean, it's absolutely true to say that more and more young people with a mental health condition are not working because of their mental health condition. But I think to sort of leap from that to say that people are choosing not to, or to imply that they're somehow making it up, is really missing a step. And that step is wondering why these young people are struggling in such a hugely elevated way. Mm. You know, it's just not the case that people can sort of rock up and say that they feel mentally unwell and automatically be entitled to out-of-work benefits. That's not how it works. And people, even with severe mental illness, often struggle to gain access to benefits. So it's not the sort of easy street that people sometimes portray it as. And it's quite damaging to people who are struggling with their mental health to imply that. But yes, it is very clear that our young people are struggling with their mental health. And we know actually that being in good employment is actually really good for your mental health. So it's really important that we do look at how we can get young people into work, make workplaces healthy for young people, and work hard to keep them there as well.
And do you think, Alexa, that we have really missed a trick in terms of how we've examined the experience and the aftermath of the pandemic, particularly for young people? Because you can see coming through, can't you, a young generation about to enter the workforce who quite clearly are struggling with some things that haven't been there before. It's very difficult to work out which bit is about the changing horizon of employment, which bit might be about being possibly overqualified to join a workforce, entry-level jobs not being there. I see that it's complicated, but we don't seem to want to talk anymore about what the pandemic, what the lockdown did. We want to move away from it, don't we?
Yeah, and I think we absolutely do have to consider that. I mean, it will have had a huge scarring impact on lots of young people in terms of how they engage with the world, in terms of how they feel about themselves and their places in it, in terms of their ability to interact socially. And all of those things are building blocks of good mental health. So yes, it's really important that we think about what we can do for those young people and how we can better support them.
What do you think we can do? I mean, it would be lovely to wave a magic wand and for everybody to be able to get a job. So let's put that to one side. From the mental health perspective, what do we need to be talking more about and doing more?
Well, what I hope the review will look at is not so much over-diagnosis, but how we can meet each level of support differently. So some people, you know, will always need psychiatric help. They will need that clinical support for a severe mental health problem. But there'll be other people who can have sort of lower level support. You know, what role can peer support have? What role can things like, for example, group singing or access to social prescribing or access to nature have in supporting people's mental health? It's really important that everybody gets the level of support that's right for them. And then that will free up the more harder end clinical support for those people who really need it.
And sorry, Alexa, I was just going to ask you, because we're running out of time a tiny bit, whether or not you think that Wes Streeting is the right man for this job. And is he saying something that actually you haven't heard before from health secretaries?
Well, I think his position has changed. I mean, he spoke in the spring speculating about overdiagnosis, and then NHS England's own figures came out in the summer and showed that it's not the case, that people actually are struggling with their mental health, that it is much poorer than before. So I'm hoping that he has had a change of heart, and certainly looking at what the review is aiming to tackle, we're really positive about it. You know, if it can find out ways to promote good mental health and prevent mental illness, then that is amazing. So we're going into the review in really good faith. And I hope that it's going to come out with some great recommendations.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this afternoon. Alexa Knight is Director of Policy and Influence at the Mental Health Foundation. Now, Rosie, I can't let a reference to community singing go past without including you in this conversation, because choirs are a huge part of your life. And actually, they do really make a difference to people's heads, don't they?
They do. So I run a community choir. It's completely free. I ask for two things, and that it's you are committed and that you're enthusiastic. So basically show up. There's no audition. If you can't sing, I don't really believe there are people who can't sing, then you come. And there is a huge variety. There's about 45 of us now who meet on a Monday night. We're already ingrained in the community. We meet at Royal Trinity Hospice just off Clapham Common, and brownies run at the same time, and guides, and they use the area so wonderfully. And there is something very uniquely bonding about standing next to someone and singing, because it's a little bit risky and it could be a little bit embarrassing, but everybody's got to do it for it to work, for the sound to work. So it's really bonding, and it's also just great. It's great fun. I mean, find a choir that does music you like, but, you know, we'll sing a bit of ABBA, Coldplay. Dare I say, we're delving into a little bit of Mariah Carey for Christmas. But it's just a total blast, and it's the best part of my week. Hands down.
You say that.
That's why I talk about it all the time. Sorry, Times Radio. And people come because they want the boost. And this all started because I moved to France, couldn't find an English speaking choir anywhere. And I thought, oh, this is, and I've worked on a breakfast program, finished really early. I didn't know what to do with myself. And I asked around, does anyone know an English speaking choir? And so many people on this sort of expats in Lyon Facebook group said, no, but I would love to join one. So I set one up and 80 people joined.
Well, good for you.
Because they needed friends, really, actually, not because they really wanted to sing. And people got married to each other who met in that choir. They became each other's babysitters, helped each other get jobs. And I was hooked from that moment on. So absolutely, a community choir for your mental health, I think, is one of the greatest things you can do.
Well, I mean, what a fantastic advertisement for community choirs. Do you know if there's any kind of register for community choirs? So if people are listening and they're in a completely different part of the country, I suppose you just type
I
in
would
community
just Google,
choir.
I mean, even where I am in South London, there are loads. One I'm in slight competition with. We always need lots more men in choirs as well. I would just Google it, and they'll definitely some. And most of them, you know, you can find ones that are free. Mine is, and there are lots of others that do the same.
Right, sounds fantastic. You are listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright. We are here on Times Radio. We are with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are one Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We're going to stick with Wix for the next couple of minutes because many of you have been entering our Wix Peacock Awards with the opportunity to win a £250 Wix voucher. You've been telling us who you think should win that and why. We're going to do some of the contenders in this hour, some in the next hour, and we will be announcing the winner just before 4 o'clock.
So you've got plenty of time to still get your entry in. Carol, my heart goes out to you. Carol says, I put my first ever shelf up at the weekend and it's straight and still up. Big tick. Thought at 64 time I learned how to use the drill. So whilst I had guidance from my husband, I still did it by myself. But she says, I caught our low level drive wall with the car yesterday. So now wondering if I could rebuild that myself too. I'm with you, Carol. That sounds bad. I don't know how that conversation went. Lisa, this is lovely. I'd like to nominate my sister, Carol, who's rescued and saved thousands of little hedgehog lives. She rears hoglets. That is an excellent word on a day we're talking about words. If they're orphaned, nurses hedgehogs back to health so they can be released. It's hours of work. She spends all her money on medication, food supplies, heating, care costs. She makes me so proud for what she's achieved. She even helps set up help for hogs.
So in my contenders pile, we have Carla. What's making me proud is I've fitted my whole downstairs with a wooden floor this week, whilst my, in inverted commas, manly partner who thought I couldn't do it was out at work. This one comes in from Craig, who would like to nominate his niece, Sophie Cullen, for the Wix Peacock Awards. She's making her professional pantomime debut this year, appearing in Sleeping Beauty at the Towngate Theatre Basildon. That's a lovely shoe-in. And this one comes in from Ashley. It's my favourite so far. My partner is expecting our first baby in February and has powered through like a trooper. I'd like to nominate her to win as she deserves it for what her body is going through.
Excellent.
So you do still have time to send us an email. It's very simple, the criteria. As you can tell, you just have to nominate somebody who you think is deserved of a £250 Wix voucher. You can send us a WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353 or you can email janeandfee@times.radio and we will announce the winner with drumroll at the end of the show.
Now, the world has been captivated by the adventures of a drunk raccoon. The poor raccoon, well, poor, it was definitely poor in a few hours. The animal fell through the ceiling of a liquor store in Virginia and apparently then rampaged through the shop, drinking as he went. He was found passed out, spread out like a starfish, very near to the toilet. But the question of why animals drink and what it tells us about them is a bit of a deeper one. For more help, I spoke to the scientist and the animal behaviourist Justin Gregg. He's also the author of If Nietzsche Were a Narwhal, What Animal Intelligence Reveals About Human Stupidity. And I started by asking what he made of the raccoon's tail.
I think there's two explanations. One, the least likely, the raccoon had had previous experience with alcohol and decided he liked it and then saw some bottles and broke them and drank them because he wanted to get drunk. That's very unlikely. The more likely explanation is that he was attracted to the smell of alcohol because in the animal kingdom, ripe fruit starts to ferment and it makes an alcohol smell. So that is an indication that a fruit is full of sugar and ready to be eaten. So a lot of animals are attracted to the smell of alcohol.
But what about the impact that alcohol has on you? And it did have a big impact on this raccoon. Would something kick in to say, do you know what, I can't drink any more of this for an animal as it would for us?
I would assume so. I mean, the alcohol is an accidental byproduct of the fermentation process. And then the alcohol gets into the system of the raccoon. And then, you know, alcohol makes mammals feel good most of the time. So it would have felt good and then started to feel sick. The question is, did the raccoon have the association with feeling bad to the alcohol? Maybe or maybe not, especially if it was his first time.
Yes. Would a raccoon recognize a hangover?
Yeah. Well, the question is the raccoon going to go back and try it again? That's the million-dollar question, because if he enjoyed the process, which is possible, he might now be on the lookout for liquor stores.
I know you've said before, why would an organism, or in this case we're talking a raccoon or an elephant, seek out a mind-altering substance if there isn't a mind to alter? What do you think is the nature of, let's say, the raccoon or the elephant mind compared to ours?
Well, that's it. I find that this is great evidence that the animal obviously has a mind and some knowledge of its own mind and goes and seeks out a pleasure, a substance that can produce pleasure or an altered state, it wouldn't make any sense if there wasn't some form of consciousness or at least a mind of some kind that can be altered. So when an insect is doing it, it's clear evidence to me that something sophisticated is going on in the brain of the animal.
So how might we see that in, let's say, our pets, cats, dogs, rabbits, hamsters?
Like a catnip comes to mind. I feed my cat catnip all the time. Fantastic stuff. It's funny to see animals drunk or intoxicated because it's very human-like, so we really enjoy watching an animal being slightly intoxicated. Although generally it's probably pretty dangerous. Like this raccoon recovered, which is great, but there's that famous cocaine bear. I don't know if you know this story.
No.
There's a movie, it's a comedy movie based off a real story of a cocaine that had fallen out of an airplane into the wilderness, and a bear ate all of the cocaine and then died from the cocaine. But probably while eating was probably pleasurable up until death.
Oh, that is it's a horrible story. And of course, we're not encouraging you to sort of get any pets drunk. Of course, it should go without saying. Yeah. It does speak to the kind of the brain that you think is inside the animal. How intelligent would you say animals are? And are they on a spectrum? Because I think we associate intelligence with animals like octopuses, you know, these very intricate. They seem to have sort of emotional as well as sort of a physical intelligence.
Yeah, usually when we say intelligence, we're asking if an animal sort of behaves in a human-like way, because we're sort of the bar that we're talking about when we're comparing intelligence. So if an octopus suddenly does something like, problem-solving by opening a jar and finding a food reward in there, we're like, oh, that's just like what a human would do. So we think of that as intelligent. But of course, an octopus lives in a world that's very different from us, and so they're ability to do complex cognitive things isn't always human-like, but it's still nonetheless fascinating. So intelligence is kind of in the eye of the beholder. There's lots of species doing really amazing things that aren't human-like, but I would still label that intelligent.
I wondered then, do you think we underestimate animal intelligence?
I'd say most of the time, yes. The history of the study of animal cognition is that we keep finding from year to year more complicated things going on in animals' brains than we ever thought possible. Maybe we're not as surprised these days about primates, but we find insects doing really complicated things, and that always surprises us. So we're always constantly surprised, which means we therefore must be underestimating their intelligence.
What might those insects be doing?
They're good at problem solving as well. They have some counting abilities and things like that. I think it's interesting because we think of tiny little brains as not capable of producing complex cognition and thought. But the reality is, I don't think brain size is that big of a deal. If you put any combination of neurons together in just the right way, you can get complexity of all kinds.
Final thing, when children are very little, when they tell lies, it's always sort of stamped a marker of sort of, well, that was an intelligent thing to do. You know, whether you say, oh, that cup broke because a lion came in here and knocked it over. And you think, oh, right, you've realized there's a way to work around this. Can animals lie?
That is a great question, and it seems like lying is a very human thing to do. So that might be something that most animals cannot achieve, and that's because our form of intelligence is that I can guess what you are thinking and you can guess what I'm thinking. Therefore, I can manipulate your thoughts by producing false information. So it requires a lot of complex understanding of each other's thinking, and that is something animals struggle with. They don't really necessarily have that same complex knowledge of each other's minds that humans do. That might be the thing that we do best.
That is the animal behaviorist Justin Gregg. So the raccoon can get drunk but can't lie about it after.
Okay. Yep, I've met people like that. But they do. Actually, they say they don't, but they do. Do you want to do the fantastic story from Debs?
Yes, afternoon, Debs. He says, a friend's daughter volunteered to look after the school hamster for the Christmas holiday. I was presenting the kitchen during a particularly rowdy and riotous Christmas party. Also, it was, sorry, in the kitchen during this party. Drunkenness was partly enabled by the 100% Christmas cake on offer that clearly was laced with alcohol. The hamster was discovered slumped against the cage door the following morning, surrounded by cake crumbs. When the door was opened, the hamster fell out of the cage in a stupor. It survived both the alcohol and the fall, but took the rest of the Christmas period to recover.
the poor hamster. It was thought its relentless cycling on its wheel during this period was an attempt to distract from its withdrawal symptoms.
So sad.
So keep Christmas cake laced with alcohol away from animals.
Now, do we have, just before we go to the news, a tiny little Ryan Spectacular? That is Ryan demonstrating in audio sound effects a raccoon getting drunk in a liquor store. Let's get the news with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. An inquiry into the death of Dawn Sturgis after the Salisbury poisonings says Vladimir Putin, his deputies and his spies bear sole moral responsibility for her death. She died in 2018 after spraying herself with Novichok, a nerve agent which Russian spies had discarded months before after trying to kill former spy Sergei Skripal. Lord Hughes's inquiry says no medical help could have saved Ms Sturgis and her death was not directly caused by failures by British authorities. Lawyer Marsha Willis-Stewart read a statement from Dawn Sturgis's family.
We have always wanted to ensure that what happened to Dawn will not happen to others. The report today contains no recommendations. That is a matter of real concern. There should be, there must be, reflection and change.
The UK has sanctioned Russia's spy agency as a result. Flu cases are at a record high for this time of year. The NHS Chief Executive Sir Jim Mackey says resident doctors are reckless to be planning a strike in the run-up to Christmas as cases surge. Downing Street has rejected criticism of the Prime Minister being a dictator after delaying four mayoral elections due in May. The government says there needs to be more work done to set up the offices to support those new roles. And in cricket, Joe Root's first test century down under has given England a boost in the second Ashes test. His 135 not out means England finished day one on 325 for nine. It means England will head out to bat again when play resumes tomorrow in Brisbane. Don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Turkey tummy, fizzy reflux, sprouts, gastric trouble can feel like the festive gift that keeps on giving. At the first sign of discomfort, think Pepto-Bismol.
When you have nausea, heartburn,
Pepto-Bismol coats and soothes your stomach for effective five-symptom relief. Pepto-Bismol oral suspension contains bismuth subsalicylate. Always read the label.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Bathrooms. The free bathroom design service includes a home visit. So when you're ready to plan your new bathroom, let the Wickes experts measure up for you. Get started by booking a free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Not long now until we announce the winner of the Wickes Peacock Award, and that winner gets a £250 voucher to spend in a Wickes store. You've just got to nominate someone who you think is deserving of the prize. So somebody who's done a lot of DIY, wants to do a lot of DIY, has done DIY with meaning, something like that. You can text us. You can WhatsApp us, 0333 003 2353, or you can send an email to janeandfee@times.radio. Now, last week, while we were digesting the fallout from the Chancellor's budget, something else happened that was significant for the UK's future. It happened in space. Three satellites were launched into orbit, the first British-designed satellites of their kind to process key national security data at speed. It is at last a good news story and one that we're going to consider. Are we doing it right now? We are. Okay, so do you know what? I'm just going to show our pants here. I was suddenly talking very slowly because usually we have a John P in our trail at this time, and I saw John approaching the studio. I thought, it's all right, I'll be able to turn this cue into a little trail. But then I saw him turn around and walk back, so I'm not. I'm going to introduce the guest. everybody on board with this. The satellites were built by BAE Systems, whose Director of Strategy, Oliver Waghorn, joins us now. Hello.
Hey, V. Hey.
Hi. I'm sorry about our slightly torturous method of getting to you, but we're with you now. Tell us a little bit more about exactly what these satellites do and just how groundbreaking and positive it is that they are now up in orbit.
Yes, really happy to do that. I mean, it's not just a good news story. It is a great news story for the UK space sector. These three satellites have been designed and built here in the UK, and as you said, launched last week. And they're going to bring a really critical sovereign asset to the UK defence and security customer in terms of gathering intelligence against a range of threats. They've got some really novel technology on board, and everybody's really excited to see what they can do.
What have we been doing before this?
Well, there's a lot of international reliance on space support. We get a lot of support from the US and European allies. And there are some ways that we can detect the radio frequency spectrum that these satellites are targeting. But to be honest, this is really groundbreaking stuff. We're very much the first to bring this set of capabilities into space together. So this is new to everybody.
So what exactly is it that we will now be able to track with these satellites?
So there's a couple of really interesting features about the three satellites we've put up. The first thing is they operate as a constellation. So they're not individual satellites flying around. They move around as a pack. They'll be about 100 kilometres apart from each other. And the reason we've done that is as you go over a target of interest, you can get some data from that target. You can understand sort of what it is. But the real key is understanding where it is and the time it is. And by having three go over at the same time, we get to triangulate that position. And this is a new thing. We've never done this before. The second thing that's a real innovation is around the software-defined nature of these satellites. So traditionally, you'd put a lot of hardware up into space, and it's got to survive a sort of technology journey. But technology is evolving so quickly. What these satellites do is they're software-defined. So a bit like your smartphone, you can upload a new app and tell it to do new things, and you're not having to launch a whole new satellite. So some really novel things that these satellites are going to be able to do.
Mm. They were taken up there, weren't they, Oliver, by SpaceX. How much does the world and does your business really need SpaceX at the moment?
Well, I think need's a bit strong. They're certainly a really compelling offer. The reason we went for them is they're a low-risk, low-cost option. But there are alternatives. There are European launch capabilities. And as you know, the UK in a number of places is looking at a UK launch capability. So I think need is a bit strong, but it worked really well for us, and it's been a really productive partnership. But as we look forward, we're open to other ways of getting into space.
How close are we to having exactly that kind of capability in this country?
We're not a space launch company, so I can't really give you an accurate answer to that. I know it's an ambition of the UK government, and they've got a number of horses in the race, if you will. It's still a priority for them, but it's really a question for them rather than us.
Yeah, no, for sure. I strongly suspect, though, Oliver, you know way more about it than I do. Tell me a little bit about who else is up there in space. How full is space of this kind of kit at the moment? And who is trying to make sure that it doesn't become too crowded?
Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, everybody's in space. And I think this is one of the things that people don't really recognise is the density of space in terms of the satellites that are up there and the roles they fulfil. They're not just about government surveillance and intelligence capabilities. Almost all parts of our day of life rely on space communications, agriculture, entertainment, the commercial sector, financial trading, broadcast. You know, if space were to cease as a domain, all of that falls apart. So it's an incredibly congested space. And actually, it's a really well-regulated one for the most part. You know, the UK with allies have got a very sort of consistent and measured approach to deconflicting space. So it is busy, but it's well attended to.
And do you have concerns about the politics of space, purely from your perspective at BAE Systems? Because I know that in a wider context, there are concerns, I mean, basically about the fact that the most important players on Earth have become the most important players in space. And so countries who don't carry that kind of weight on planet Earth will never be able to have that kind of influence in space.
Yeah, I think there is a recognition by the UK generally, to the government and industry, and for our part in that, that sovereign space capability is important. You know, we've seen over the recent years there is a risk of overdependence, and in many respects, this is our response to that. You know, the UK government's really keen to see the UK step forward as a UK sovereign space player. And these satellites have been designed and built here in the UK with companies from all over the UK and partnerships with universities. So this is as much about creating a sovereign space ecosystem in the UK as it is launching the three satellites that we've put up there. So I think there's a real recognition of everything you've said, and the UK collectively is doing something about that.
We are considering another story today, Oliver, on a completely different kind of level about sinister Russian activity in this country. And I think for many people, we are only just beginning to realise what might sometimes lie behind the surface of society here. What should we make of the kind of things that you're doing? I mean, when you say that we're at the forefront of technology, that universities and researchers here have developed this, you know, we know that there are dark forces who want that research, who want that technology, they want that intelligence. Are they getting it?
There's no question of the want. I think in many respects, this is our contribution, or part of our contribution in trying to defend the UK. And we open by talking about defence and intelligence. And there are definitely sort of those core applications of a system such as this, but it's not limited to that. So take, for example, counter-narcotics and counter-piracy. So state threats, but not in the same way, but of serious concern to the UK. You know, when a sanctions vessel is trying to transit with illegal material and it turns off an AIS transponder to become what we call a dark ship, it's exactly these kind of capabilities that are going to allow us to identify, detect and track those kind of vessels. So whether it's a state threat, a state-sponsored threat or a non-state threat, these kind of technology responses are just the thing that the UK needs.
And we're good at it.
We're great at it. And this is one of those things that I think people struggle with a bit, is the UK has some fantastic space pedigree. I mean, we've got hundreds of people in the Southeast alone supporting this programme. It's been enough to sponsor a space degree level apprenticeship with Portsmouth University. We've hired five of those apprentices ourselves. There's a really rich ecosystem alive and well in the UK.
That is so good to hear. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That is Oliver Waghorn, who is Director of Strategy at BAE Systems. Before anybody texts in to say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because they're satellites built by BAE Systems. I think sometimes we also have to err on the side of positivity and accept that some of the stuff we do in this country is still, it is world leading, to use a phrase from the pandemic that perhaps you didn't want to hear again. It is a 2:45. If you'd like to contact us this afternoon, we are 0333 003 2353, and we're Jane and Fee at times.radio, and Rosie Wright is here with me this afternoon. You'll be here next Wednesday and Thursday as well. We have done an interview after 3:30 with Susie Dent, where you reveal your fear of words.
Yes, which I'm regretting having done already twice now. First at the top of this programme and then again at 3:30. Talking of positivity, Susie Dent is really keen that we use words more positively, saying, you know, why would we always call someone dishevelled? Why do we always put that negative start to the word? It was a brilliant conversation. Lots of you getting in touch on your sort of quirks with words and sort of reminders of words that we should be using. New to me, did you know that we had the word overmorrow? It means the day after tomorrow. Bring that back.
I didn't, but it sounds so old-fashioned, doesn't it? I'll meet you in the overmorrow.
Susie Dent says that if a word has become extinct, we can rally against that by just simply using it. So if you want a campaign for overmorrow to be back, you just have to simply use it. Another message here, wasn't it David Cameron who would sign off correspondence with LOL, thinking it meant lots of love?
He wasn't alone in that, I don't think.
No, it's laugh out loud.
Absolutely, yes. So we're going to be looking at words and slang and the origin of language, particularly the origin of new phrases like that new 6-7 craze that is plaguing primary school classrooms. All of that to come at 3:30. But before that, we're going to get a sneak peek at this weekend's Times magazine with the associate editor, Jane Mulcairns. It is now 2:47. This is Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
This Christmas, Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's Biscuits invite you to experience a Yuletide trip you'll never forget. Search Times Radio competitions and enter to win an enchanting 3-night Christmas getaway for two in either Vienna, Prague or Copenhagen, courtesy of Thomas Fudge's Remarkable Biscuits. This delicious experience includes flights, luxury hotel accommodation, dinner and £500 spending money. Celebrate Christmas in style with Times Radio and Thomas Fudge's. Hats off to Remarkable Biscuits.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Strictly Come Dancing, the live tour, returns. Join the judges, Shirley Ballas, Anton Dubek and Craig Revel-Horwood, and your host, Jeanette Monrara, for a dose of thoroughly feel-good entertainment. Strictly Come Dancing, the live tour. Coming to an arena near you. Book your tickets now.
This is Times Radio.
It is 10 minutes to 3 in the studio. Jane Mulcairns, the associate editor at The Times magazine. Jane, good afternoon.
Hello, Rosie.
We've got to start with something pretty bleak, but really important. This is the story of John Smythe, the lawyer, the Christian evangelist, the Church of England's most prolific serial abuser. Quite amazingly, Andrew Billen has done an interview with his children to reveal some of the most sort of chilling personality traits that this man had as a dad. What have we learned?
Yeah, well, I mean, most people probably remember, you know, some details about the story of John Smythe, who was, I mean, his case was sort of mostly uncovered by our own Kathy Newman with Channel 4 News. John Smythe ran summer camps, Christian evangelist summer camps, from the 1970s, really, until his death in 2018. And it's estimated that he abused at least 130 boys in England and in Africa. But what we haven't really heard before is the testimony of his own family. And there's a new documentary next week coming out with his son and his daughter, and also his wife. And Andrew Billen has spoken to PJ, his son, and Fiona, his daughter. And it's a really, really heartbreaking read. You know, there are memories that PJ's had of his own violence towards him, which he wasn't even sure if they were real until he sort of verified them with one of the authors of the book. His own career as a minister in the church has been affected because after his father was exposed, he was basically asked to stand down from a church that he was a pastor at. His daughter, who is married with children, hasn't ever spoken about this before. So this is really the first time that his family have spoken. And it's a really, really moving interview, really, about sort of the repercussions of his family. I mean, and there are some horrible details that they will remember. He abused a lot of boys in the shed at the bottom of their garden in Hampshire. And they do remember a white flag being outside the shed when they weren't allowed to go down to the shed in their own garden. As part of the documentary, they do also have a meeting with their mother in which they talk about all of this. We're not allowed to talk about the details of that until the documentary airs. But interestingly, they're both still quite religious. PJ remains a pastor in the church and Fiona remains religious as well, which I don't know. I mean, when you think about the fact that the church is accused of having a conspiracy of silence around this case, and the Archbishop of Canterbury ended up having to resign over it, although he still claims that he had no knowledge of the abuse. I don't know. As a member of his family, I think I might. It might slightly question my allegiance in some ways, but they remain faithful and really extraordinary interviewees.
Yeah, PJ said his faith was tested but not destroyed. Mm. So it's going to be a really fascinating documentary. And Andrew does sort of tease out these heartbreaking details before his daughter saying of her dad, I feared him, I didn't love him, he was bad-tempered, very volatile. It is extremely sort of gut-wrenching and moving, so well worth reading. Should we turn to something much more charming? This is a fantastic piece, MAGAland. What a wild ride it has been the last 6 months to be Washington editor of the Times. This is Katie Balls, who has had 10 years in Westminster. She knows the ropes. She's very well known. Turns up in Washington to try and get her teeth into the political beat there. Finds out it's a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I mean, 6 months ago, Katie sort of landed in Washington. And I honestly don't think she's had a day off since. I mean, she really works so hard for the Times and the Sunday Times. But as she often says, what a time to be a Washington correspondent. It's a really, really brilliant piece. Katie's such a brilliant scoop getter as well as a brilliant writer. So, I mean, it was Katie who identified early in her time there that we should be interviewing Charlie Kirk. And she spent the weekend with him at a Turning Point convention in the summer. So we had him on the cover, thanks to Katie, a month before he was shot dead. So she really is just an extraordinary getter of stories and to get under the skin of a place. But she writes in this piece that it was like landing on another planet after being in Westminster for so long. But she found some comfort in the fact that Trump world was new to everyone. She talks about the fact that all of these Washington veterans found everything shifting under their feet. Mm. And a lot of these people had just come in from Florida who were not Washington insiders, and that the whole landscape had changed. And basically they were sort of saying, you know, it doesn't really matter if you've been in DC for 25 years. You still might not know this administration. I mean, there's lots of things she talks about, sort of the details of life there. People get up at 5 a.m, but they often finish work at 4 in order to get happy hour.
Okay.
I mean, that sounds like not nothing dissimilar to a breakfast show.
Nothing wrong with getting up at 5 a.m.
I don't know that you go to happy hour all the time, though, do you, Rosie?
But it's
tucked
also
up alone. But she also talks about this sort of the transient nature of DC, which I thought was really interesting. So when I was in New York for a decade, I found New York more transient than London, for sure. But DC in this piece just sounds not just transient, but really transactional as well. She writes that it's a city that's used to old friends leaving and new ones arriving every day. Fresh arrivals land in Washington almost weekly, parachuted in from campaign war rooms in Florida, Texas, or Ohio, or plucked from the online system of MAGA influencers and suddenly find themselves with a West Wing badge. And I think maybe as a sort of export, you know, as a sort of plant straight into that, that probably makes life a little bit easier to know that it is, you can make friends very quickly. Probably no one will miss you when you're gone, but
yes.
It's a city that's very honest, I guess, about the transaction nature of what everybody needs and wants.
But don't you wonder about the real Washingtonians, how they cope with that? Because what we're talking about is the political society that exists on the top. And actually, if you're born and bred Washington, and this is just the latest wave of blow-ins of a different political persuasion, I'd be fascinated in hearing their stories.
Well,
too.
I have friends who were born and bred there, who grew up there. But that's what the city runs on, because it's really interesting in the US because of the decentralized nature of cities. So New York is a financial hub, but not a political hub. DC is the political hub, but not the financial hub.
And
so
Florida's empty.
Well, actually, it's not. Florida's full of tech bros and cryptocurrency bros who've all moved there because there's very low taxation. But people move to Washington for this. I mean, as my friends who live there sort of talk about it being full of sort of class presidents and the head prefects, and it's not a place, if you're into like edgy fashion, you wouldn't want to live there.
You won't thrive, yes.
And you know, it's got a better restaurant scene than it used to, but it's still quite bad. But Washingtonians are just, that they're used to that city. That's what they've grown up with.
It's really interesting to look at how Katie sort of tried to navigate that. But she also ended up right in the heart of the White House press operation very quickly.
Yes.
I mean, that we all know Caroline Leavitt, now the youngest ever press secretary to Donald Trump.
27.
She
Wild.
Shared a screenshot of one of Katie's pieces that got clicked on 25 million times.
Yeah.
That article.
I mean, it is really funny. Katie talks about how Trump interacts more directly with the press than any former president has ever done. And that her own great anecdote about this was that she was just before the UN General Assembly in New York, she wrote a story on how much love, little love is lost between Trump and the UN. And she she'd been joking with some of the staff at the UN about how they were going to turn off the lifts and the escalators and tell Trump he had to take the stairs to prove a point about the funding cuts that he was bringing in. And then as she watched in New York, he was entering the building, stepped on the escalator with Melania. We all remember the scene.
Oh, yes.
And then it stopped. And when she was on her way back to Washington, D.C., she saw her phone blowing up and Caroline Levitt had shared a screenshot of Katie's Sunday Times column and basically saying it was sabotage because Katie, she sort of was basically saying that Katie had had a leaked story that they were genuinely going to turn the escalators off, whereas Katie was just sort of making a little bit of a joke about it. But anyway, 25 million people saw our Times Insiders Sunday Times
and that
column.
That really was the inside scoop. final thing, there's a piece about Sydney Sweeney who has caused an awful lot of controversy recently. Sorry to talk about this right now at this time of day, but because of wearing very revealing outfits, including showing her
there's
nipples.
No better time of day.
but also,
to say, I think 2 minutes to three is perfect for this.
Also, her American Eagles jeans advert that was very provocative. Oh, you think not?
I mean, this I think it was slightly a storm in a pair of jeans, that story.
We were quite raunchy in a pair of jeans.
It was August. I feel like everyone just kind of made a bit of a fuss about nothing.
But she found favour with Donald Trump, who then tweeted, look, Sydney Sweeney, a registered Republican, is the hottest ad out there. She's been nicknamed sort of MAGA's new it girl. Yeah. She's trying to do something very different to that, and that's proving tricky.
Yeah, so we have an interview in the magazine with Christy Martin, who is the real-life boxer. She's a female boxer. Sydney Sweeney plays her in this new film about her life, and it has bombed at the box office in America. It's only just out here. We don't have any figures yet on how it's doing in the UK. But a lot of people are blaming it on the fact that it's Sydney Sweeney playing Christy. A lot of critics have said she's actually great in the role and she, you know, really, really trained for it quite seriously and quite hard. But people are basically saying that because of the sort of the tidal wave of antipathy towards Sydney Sweeney, that that's affected the film. I don't know to what extent that is true, but I think there is a feeling out there that she's just a bit too sexy, guys.
Okay, there we go. Not in Jane Mulcairn's book. Jane, thank you very much. Associate Editor of the Times Magazine, giving us a glimpse of the articles you can read when you get the Times this weekend. Jane, thank you very much.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. In the next hour, Putin has been found morally responsible for the death of Dawn Sturgis. We will talk to Times writer and columnist Mark Urban. Egypt has renewed its call for the Rosetta Stone to be returned. We'll be joined by the chair of the Parthenon Project, Ed Vasey. And after 3:30, our big guest is lexicographer Susie Dent on her new book, The Roots We Share. Tom Noonan has the headlines.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The family of Dawn Sturgis, who died after spraying herself with a Russian nerve agent after the Salisbury poisonings, have criticised an inquiry into her death. A report has found no medical help could have saved the 44-year-old and says while there were some failings by authorities, none of them led directly to her death. Lord Hughes also says it isn't reasonable to expect British intelligence to have prepared for a Russian plot to assassinate former spy Sergei Skripal. Marcia Willis-Stewart is the family lawyer for Dawn Sturgis's family.
Today's report does not set out publicly how the risks that led to Dawn's death will be prevented in the future. Adequate risk assessment of Skripal was not done, but no protective steps were put in place. That is a serious concern for us now and for the future.
The inquiry says Vladimir Putin and Russian authorities bear moral responsibility for Ms. Sturgis' death. The UK has sanctioned the GRU spy agency as a result. And this afternoon, Vladimir Putin has arrived in India for talks with the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. A man has been charged with terror offences linked to the man who attacked Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. 31-year-old Mohammed Bashir is facing 4 charges after being accused of helping Jihad al-Shami with earlier reconnaissance of a defence facility. Al-Shami was killed by police when he attacked the synagogue in October.
Flu cases are the highest on record for this time of year, with an average 1,700 people in hospital in England every day last week. Health leaders have warned the country is facing the worst flu season for decades, putting pressure on hospitals as junior doctors prepare to stage a five-day strike before Christmas. The energy regulator says bills will have to rise to pay for a £28 billion upgrade to the network. Consumer expert Harry Kind explains Ofgem's decision.
The way that we generate and consume electricity has so changed from massive coal power stations that were supplying people and really just had to put the foot down when EastEnders finished and we all put the kettle on, to a system where the amount of generation is changing constantly with sun and with wind. And we will charge up an electric car overnight, which is maybe the equivalent of an entire house's electrical use.
Bills will go up by £116 a year. And in cricket, Joe Root's first test century in Australia helped England recover on the first day of the second Ashes test. He finished the day 135 not out, despite wickets falling around him. That's in part thanks to a productive partnership with tail-ender Jofra Archer. It means England finished the day 325 for 9. England opener Zach Crawley, who was caught for 76, paid tribute afterwards.
Yeah, we were chuffed for him. We were nervous for him for a long while before that, and you know, I think he was less nervous than us, and he played brilliantly. And I saw him in the change room. He's like his usual self. He's so humble. He's not trying to make too much of a deal of it, but I'm sure inside he's pretty delighted.
England are trying to level the series after Australia won the first test. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast
across the UK on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And a little bit later in this hour, we will be revealing who is the winner of the Wickes Proud as a Peacock competition, where you can win a £250 Wickes voucher. We've got more of your entries coming up, and you can get yours in as well by WhatsApping us 0333 003 2353. You can text the programme 87222, start your message with the word Times. And in half an hour, lexicographer extraordinaire Susie Dent is going to be here. She's written a new fantastic book, Words for Life, every day of the year a new word apt for that very specific moment, including binfluencer. You may have one on your street, you may be the resident binfluencer on your street. We'll hear from her a little bit later. But right now, 4 minutes past three, Vladimir Putin was morally responsible for the death of Dawn Sturgis, according to the inquiry into her death. She died in 2018 after spraying herself with a perfume bottle given to her as a gift. It contained the nerve agent Novichok and had been left behind by Russian agents sent to assassinate the Russian defector Sergei Skripal. The inquiry chair, Lord Hughes, said today that the three Russian agents were acting on Putin's orders.
Petrov, Bosharov and Fedotov were, as I've said, members of an operational team within the GRU. I am sure that in conducting this attack on Sergei Skripal, they must have been acting on instructions received from their superiors. And I've concluded that the operation to assassinate Sergei Skripal must have been authorised at the highest level, indeed by President Putin.
The security minister, Dan Jarvis, told MPs the UK would bring in new sanctions on the Russian GRU intelligence agency.
To date, my right honourable friend, the Foreign Secretary, has imposed a further cost on the Russian regime by sanctioning the GRU under the Russia sanctions regime, along with several associated individuals. These sanctions recognise the continued reckless and destabilising activity of the GRU, which seeks to undermine Ukraine, European security and the safety of the United Kingdom.
Mark Urban is a Times columnist, host of the Crisis Room podcast. He's covered this story since the beginning, including interviewing Sergei Skripal. Mark, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Not at all. In fact, before the beginning, in the sense that when I spoke to him, it was several months before the poisoning. I was working on a book project and I got to go into that house at Christie Miller Road in Salisbury and talk to him there, you know, at a time when, of course, Not that many people were even aware of his existence.
But clearly, the Russians were. Can we go back to the beginning, Mark, and can you remind us of what we knew at the time and has been reconfirmed today? What was an audacious, brazen assassination attempt?
Yes, I mean, look, we've got this inquiry report and you know, I was there when it opened in Salisbury back in October last year. And the inquiry counsel, the senior lawyer, basically said to the public, look, we're probably never going to be able to put these people on trial who came to Salisbury and did this. So we're going to release a lot of the evidence that the police have that backs up the judgments you heard today and you mentioned in your headlines. And so what we got over the course of the inquiry and the evidence given around this time last year, in fact, by the anti-terrorist branch, was a lot of detail, all the stuff relating to the suspects' phone records, their previous travels to other places, all the lies they'd told on their visa applications, and the ways that, you know, their false identities could be opened up and their real identities established. The operations of this GRU, that's Russian Military Intelligence Unit, that they belonged to. And indeed, the fact that they had made four trips in Salisbury up to Skripal's house. And the first one of these was, if you like, a reconnaissance trip. They did a couple of trips up for that purpose. Then on the Sunday, the 4th of March 2018, when it happened, they went up once. It's believed to put the poison, this nerve agent, onto the door handle. And then they went back again, apparently to observe Skripal as he was leaving the house. So, you know, there was evidence from CCTV, from their phones, all sorts of other things, which put them in Salisbury and in that vicinity at those times.
And what we've heard in the inquiry today, which is what we suspected but has been sort of confirmed, Putin is found to be morally responsible for her death.
Yes, I mean, the inquiry chair, Lord Hughes, he's a judge, and his entire life has been spent, you know, in the criminal justice system on this idea of beyond reasonable doubt. And he says in the report, you know, I'm not going to say as a fact anything I'm not sure of. And he says that the fact that this was ordered at the highest level, indeed he mentioned in the clip you heard there, Vladimir Putin, was a fact. Now, there's various bits of evidence for why the GRU would not do a thing like this without a high-level sign-off. But we have to ask at the end of this process whether some of the evidence he heard in secret related to that judgment, to him being so sure that Putin himself had signed off on this. And of course, we don't know that. He says to us in the report, I'm not going to tell you exactly what I heard in secret, obviously enough, but he hints that, you know, whether more could have been done to protect Skripal and indeed the kind of high-level approval for the operation were subjects that he did hear evidence about in secret. So, you know, if people were expecting a sort of slam dunk, you know, an idea that in a particular email, Putin was boasting about having ordered this operation, we didn't get that today. But we did get this factual assertion from the inquiry chair that this had happened.
You've spoken to Sergei Skripal, the target of the attack that tragically then Dawn Sturgis lost her life. Tell us why they were so interested in him and why then it was, the report concludes, that it was reasonable to assess at the time that he wasn't at a high risk of assassination. We may think, based on his background, which would be helpful if you can explain, that he would be in that category.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a really interesting subject, and it undoubtedly very much concerned Dawn Sturgis's family, which was an important question, therefore, in the way that this inquiry was constituted. Why didn't people know he was there? Why wasn't more effort made to protect him? You know, he was in that community, and Dawn Sturgis's family had said, you know, going back to the period shortly after her death, look, we didn't know this guy was here. Did putting him here put us at additional risk? All that kind of thing. Now, when I went down to talk to him several months before the poisoning, there was no obvious security at his home. And indeed, I even mentioned that to him. And then I sort of said, does anyone know I'm here? That kind of thing. And he said, well, yes, they do. But, you know, there weren't people there, bodyguards or that kind of thing. So that was one of the things I picked up while I was there. So today we have this judgment that from the inquiry, that more could have been done by way of a sort of process of constant risk assessment by the people, and that's principally MI5, the security service, who look after former agents and people who've worked for the government in these sensitive roles when they come to this country. So there was this kind of implied criticism, but at the same time, the inquiry chair said, and I think this was with an eye to things that had been said by Dawn Sturgis's family, that even if they'd got a better sense that the risk to him might have been rising, they couldn't have done anything to have actually prevented the attack. And I guess that goes to a sort of judgment about, you know, were the Russians just determined to do this and take considerable risks? Obviously, with the population of Salisbury, as we tragically saw with Dawn Sturgis, and of course, several other people were contaminated badly, including Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, and indeed, you know, more generally, with the sort of way that Russia would be regarded in the world, if you sent military officers, colonels in their intelligence service to Britain with rather flimsy fake IDs that would quickly be rumbled and using a poison that, you know, could reasonably have been assumed to have come from a Russian government lab, were you not actually deliberately saying loud and clear that this is Russia doing it? And, you know, that's all part of what I think the intelligence services and the inquiry today has concluded was part of the rationale for doing it, that it was a sort of demonstration of Russian power and that they don't forgive people who've betrayed them.
Yeah, I mean, the inquiry also said that Russian agents showed no regard for innocent lives at all. I mean, they were obviously tasked with conducting an assassination on the streets of Salisbury. They weren't successful in the aim they actually achieved to. But I mean, I think brazen is the right word.
Yeah. I mean, look, there was when I think this vial of Novichok poison was eventually found, you know, you heard these estimates from the scientists at Porton Down that the amount of poison in there was theoretically sufficient to kill thousands of people. They had, it's believed, sealed it up in plastic after they applied it to the Skripal's door handle, and before it's thought they threw it away somewhere, probably in a dustbin. So that one small measure, I guess, was taken to try and contain the risk to themselves and the people of Salisbury. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's quite possible that, you know, someone else might have found this and started playing with it or examining it, and the consequences could have been even worse. It was reckless in that sense, and it appears to have been designed to have sent a very deliberate signal, you know, to have had Russia's fingerprints, as it were, on it. You know, traitors beware.
You mentioned Dawn Sturgis's family. They've been speaking this afternoon. We can hear from them now that they said that the reports left them with some questions.
Today's report has left us with some answers, but also a number of unanswered questions. We have always wanted to ensure that what happened to Dawn will not happen to others, that lessons should be learnt, and that meaningful changes should be made. The report today contains no recommendations. That is a matter of real concern. There must be, reflection and change.
Mark, what do you think those changes should be?
Yeah, it is interesting and poignant, really, to hear them there reflecting on this. I guess they want to feel that something happens as a result of this tragedy. I think it's fair to say that one of the reasons this wasn't recommended is because it's already happened, which is the extending of much better protection to other people in a similar situation. We're not talking about very many. You could probably count them on the fingers of your hands, but these would be one or two other Russian defectors or agents who've now been resettled in this country. And indeed, there could be some individuals from, you know, terrorist or other organizations who similarly have provided intelligence to the UK in the past, and resettlement was all part of the deal with them. So it is definitely the case that security around such people has been considerably tightened since the Salisbury poisonings. And I guess we have to accept that in the absence of formal recommendations, as Dawn's family said, that's the change that will come about. I think probably Lord Hughes struggled with the question of, look, what was what happened here so singular, so unusual, both that it's hard to see how it could have been prevented and indeed hard to see how it can be prevented in the future. And I guess in the end, with these things, you end up with a tightening of procedures. I mean, at one point, he was critical of the security service for not doing more regular risk assessments of, you know, was it really safe for Skripal to be at home with no CCTV, you know, no close protection. He was on the electoral roll, you know, people could find him indeed, and that helped me to find him when I wanted to talk to him. You know, so I guess in that sense, there have been changes, because I don't think any Russian who's worked for the British government would be living in quite such an exposed way anymore, that they have learned their lessons in that sense, the security service.
And you mentioned how some things have changed since this was, of course, back in 2018. I wonder, in that time frame, how have Russia's aims and strategies and tactics changed?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. In fact, it is in part the subject of a video I've just made for the Times Originals channel, which is that I think partly as a result of what's happened, and of course now, you know, since the Ukraine war started, there's been a much closer attention given to servants of the Russian state to travel in and out of Russia. Obviously, a lot of services were stopped after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, that the Russian intelligence people have started to use different methods. And the idea of sending two colonels in Russian military intelligence to Salisbury to carry out a poisoning, you know, today seems much less likely for that reason. And one of the techniques they've been using, and we saw this in a trial that ended earlier this year in the Old Bailey, was to hire British petty criminals, drug dealers, to go and set fire to a warehouse in London where supplies were being gathered for Ukraine. And indeed, across Europe, there have been many other plots of this kind. In other words, people are hired, they're taken on, often online, by Russian intelligence to carry out acts of sabotage or intelligence gathering, and their own people are not risked in the same way. And indeed, your listeners may be interested to learn that one of the things I was told recently by a contact is that those two individuals who appear on the CCTV in Salisbury, you know, going down to carry out that poisoning, are now among the people who train others, including many third country nationals, to carry out operations in Western Europe.
Mark, it's been fascinating to hear the details of your reporting, how you sort of sensed this story before it turned out to be, well, really the global story that it's become. Mark, thank you. Mark Urban, the Times writer and columnist who's extensively covered the Salisbury poisonings.
I find that last point that Mark has made extraordinary. So the two gentlemen, and people will remember that they appeared on camera justifying their visit to Salisbury with the fact that they wanted to see a tall spire and a cathedral. They appear to be absolute Muppets, to use a technical term. The idea that they are still in employment and they're the ones who are training other operatives to come and do terrible things on our shores. We are just such a long way from understanding the logic of the attitude that Russia has towards us and the rest of the world. Jane and Fee at times.radio is our email address. We're 0333 003 2353. If you are on the edge of your seat in anticipation about who might win the Wix Peacock Awards, we'll bring you the final decision just before 4 o'clock, but we've got lots of new other entries to get through as well, and we will do that in a couple of moments' time. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly. So must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Together with Wix, we want to know your proudest moment of the week to be in with a chance to win a £250 Wix voucher in our Wix Peacock Awards. This comes in from Holly. I'd like to nominate my boyfriend Tom, who deserves to be proud as a peacock because he's about to exchange on his first flat. He's been working so hard and has been searching for a place for over 2 years and has finally found somewhere. It definitely needs a new bathroom, though, and he really wants me to move in with him, but I've told him I won't until he's got the new bathroom. Jane and Fee, I'm sure you'll appreciate that a woman needs a nice bathroom. We're absolutely on board with you, Holly. This Wix voucher would be a great start. Well, we'll pop that in the pile. Maybe we should help love on its way. This one comes in from Rianne, who says, I want to nominate our daughter to encourage her efforts to learn and understand how to do some simple and challenging DIY tasks as she refurbishes her first home. Sharon is feeling very proud of her son, Jamie, and his wife, Alice, because they've renovated their house for the last 18 months. They've nearly finished and are expecting the first grandchild in February. A mention as well to Bradley and to Janet. You are definitely in the pile. To Elizabeth Clare as well, who has texted in. And Katie Dixon has taught herself how to tile and has done her whole bathroom. Every time I walk in, I grin like a proud peacock. So you go into the pile as well. Do you have some, Rosie?
Yes, Kerry would like to nominate her stepdaughter, Charlotte. She and her boyfriend bought their first flat this year. However, says Kerry, it's Charlotte who's doing all the DIY, making wooden seats and bedside tables, as well as fixing the roof of her conservatory. That is not a small project. She isn't scared of hard work and amazingly has no experience. She's dainty and not scared of power tools. Well, Charlotte, you are very much nominated. Your boyfriend is not, ever thanks to your stepmother. Nicola says, I'm feeling proud as a peacock after painting up and fixing all my kitchen units and handles, save a fortune, looks like new. You are in the awards. Lawrence is nominating her husband, Andrew, who doesn't like and isn't the best at DIY, but we needed a new shed after our last one rot away and collapsing. He built one on Saturday out in the cold and the rain.
That's impressive, isn't it? You've still got time to get your nominations in. Something that has made you incredibly proud that somebody else has done that's kind of adjacent to the DIY world. That's all you need to tell us about. We're 0333 003 2353. Alison Kogel, don't worry, you're in the mix as well, nominating your son, Rob, a primary school teacher who works incredibly hard for his 29 pupils and has also managed to buy his own house finally this year. Coming up after 3:30, we've got a lovely conversation for you with Susie Dent, every day you can hear that 3:30 interview on the podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee, which is continuing even though Jane is away at the moment. Recent interviewees include Louise Penny, Petula Clark and Lady Glenconner. And last week, Jane spoke to the screenwriter Sally Wainwright. Her latest show, Riot Women, follows five menopausal women who've come together to form a punk rock band. Now, Sally has faced some criticism that the show lacks positive male characters. Jane asked her what she made of it.
I say watch 95% of television if you want to watch men. It's interesting people say this. You know, look at the women, that none of them are perfect. They're interesting. The other thing to say is, I've had so many criticisms. Sally Wainwright hates men. Sally Wainwright is a misandrist. You know, nobody accuses whoever wrote The Good and the Bad and the Ugly of being hating women just because there aren't any women in it. It's bonkers. It's so gendered, this criticism. You know, the show is about how women are often abused by men. So the men in the show have to be those kind of men. You know, and having said that, there are nice men in the show.
That's Sally Wainwright in a fantastic conversation with Jane that you can hear on the Off Air podcast. If you've got the Times app, then you just go to Times Radio. Along the bottom, you've got podcast. Click on that and Off Air with Jane and Fee will come up right away. You've got about 7,643 episodes to choose from. Don't say we don't work hard for you. I just want to say a very quick hello to John in Sheffield, who is today's slightly cheeky what's it. Is that Fee? I've been trying to get some replacement drawer runners for my Wick Sync base unit. Can you tell me when they're in stock and how much they'll cost? And can you fit them for me too? As we've said before, Wicks are the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Jane and I do not come and do the fitting ourselves.
However, if you did, you could be nominated for...
That's very true. Nobody would want me to come round and do DIY in their house.
Don't say that because the text will come in to say, yes, they would. You could sort of come for tea.
No, it's not my forte. And being a woman of slightly short stature, I can't mend anything that's over the kind of 5'6" mark anyway. I don't like to go up a ladder. Mm. I have to get people round to screw in my light bulbs. So you wouldn't want me anywhere near your DIY.
So there are some significant limitations there to feasibility.
Yes, there are.
Susie Dent is on the way after the news at 3:30. It has got you going on words, phrases, linguistic rules that get you annoyed. Nicola says it's frustrating when people say different to instead of different from. Listening while making my homemade mincemeat. Lovely. Paul says my shout at the television words are legendary. He's not. He actually existed. And iconic, which should mean relating to an image. So music lives, for example, can't be iconic. Maybe we do use iconic in the wrong sense.
Oh, and I think there are so many cliches that we fall into on the radio and so many really silly words that are only used by journalists. I don't think many people talk about droves of things, but that is a very universally abused word in journalism. People don't use revel in the same way that journalists use it. So there are always people who are late night revelers. And I defy anybody out there to have phoned up a mate on a Friday night and said, would you like to come reveling with me? And nobody really uses blaze, which is a terrible kind of second mention in journalism when you're talking about a fire. So there are all kinds of things that I know get on people's wicks, but are also quite fascinating at the same time.
Yes, on people's wicks. We're very having a wicks moment today. Rob says, don't get me started on basically, and then some furious emojis. Mark says, I don't like people talking about optics.
Optics. I'm with you on that. What are the optics? Yep.
Yeah. Well, Susie, who's obviously the queen of words, you know, she's done Dictionary Corner Countdown for 30 years. And she says it's really frustrating when people say, oh, do you not yet know every word in the dictionary? And she will honestly put her hands up and say, no, I don't. However, she's published this fantastic book, For a New Word a Day. So if you're keen to expand your vocabulary and lean into a bit more of those language lessons and the sort of joys of linguistics, then she'll be here in just a moment or two. But first, at 3:30, let's check on the latest news headlines now with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Rosie. Good afternoon. The family of Dawn Sturgis, the woman who died from Novichok nerve agent in the wake of the Salisbury poisonings, has criticised the inquiry into her death. They say that they have real concern there's no public recommendations in the report. They've also criticised Wiltshire Police for suggesting Miss Sturgis was a drug addict at the time. Chief Constable Catherine Roper says sorry.
First of all, I need to apologise again. You're quite right that in press releases, Wiltshire Police did at the time allude to the fact that Dawn may have been a user of drugs. And that was wrong, and I am sorry, and I have said sorry, and I truly, truly mean it. And this is part of where our active actions by Wiltshire Police may have caused more harm and made it more difficult for Dawn's family and friends.
Lord Hughes's inquiry has found no medical help could have saved Dawn Sturgis, and failings by UK authorities did not directly lead to her death. He says sole moral responsibility lies with Vladimir Putin and Russian agents. The UK has signed a defence pact with Norway to run a combined fleet to hunt down Russian submarines. The government says it's aimed at protecting North Sea undersea cables. A man arrested by police investigating stabbings at Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester in October has been charged with terrorism offences. They don't directly link to that attack, though, but to allegations Mohammed Bashir helped the attacker scope out a defence facility at an earlier date. And Joe Root's first test century in Australia has given England a boost in the second Ashes test. His 135 not out means England finished day one on 325 for nine. Play resumes tomorrow in Brisbane. Don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from home instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year, we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Expert recommendations for the best TV, film and music. The To-Do List, Sunday nights from 11:30 with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, we know that many of you are very eagle-eared when you listen to Times Radio. It's because you're so bloomin' intelligent. And you will have spotted that Ed Vasey was in our billing at 3 o'clock this afternoon as chair of the Parthenon Project. He was going to tell us about his thoughts about Egypt demanding the return of the Rosetta Stone. So we phoned him and then we tried to Zoom him and then we phoned him again and he's just on voicemail. I think probably, as we are 3:30 now on a Thursday, this may fall into what would be in Ed's diary as after lunch. Mm. And obviously what's happening after lunch, Lord Vasey, is that, I don't know, you're forgetting your requirements to your radio station. So Rosie and I are deeply hurt, aren't we?
We are.
We are wounded.
Do you know, that's the second, I mentioned, the second of our colleagues to let us down in an hour.
Okay. This is very bad. So apparently we're phoning him now, but I don't really want to do the item now. We'll run out of time, won't we? You want me to do the item, do you?
I think an Ed can do it quickly.
Okay, so we're going to do the world's quickest 1 minute with Lord Vasey about returning the Rosetta Stone. Is he there now? Can you put him through? Hello?
Hello. I was just taking my dog back from the dentist.
You are taking your dog back to the dentist. Now, if that is not an excuse from the dentist. Right.
Three molars removed.
Now you see, the way that you can tell when somebody's fibbing is when they add unnecessary detail. And I think I was prepared to believe you. I was going to believe you at the dog dentist because it seemed so random. But now you've put in the three molars, I don't believe you at all. I hope it was a lovely lunch and I hope you had pudding as well and maybe a little Calvados afterwards. We've now got a minute. We've got a minute to talk about the Rosetta Stone. Egypt has asked for it back. Do you think that's the right thing to do?
No, I don't. As you know, I would like to see the Parthenon sculptures go back because I think they were wrongfully taken and also unites a piece of art. The Rosetta Stone is different. It was basically a piece of junk. I mean, it's a sort of piece of accounting. It was being used as a brick in a wall. It was discovered by French soldiers and then somehow fell into hands of British. That's point number one. So it's not a sort of huge artistic work. Secondly, we have as much say over the Rosetta Stone as the Egyptians because we used it to decipher hieroglyphics. It was the work, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, your listeners will know, but it was the work of academics in the 19th century in Britain that used the Rosetta Stone to decrypt, if you like, hieroglyphics. So we have as much say over it in terms of our contribution to scholarship of ancient Egypt. And the wider question is, how do you deal with these contested issues if you have a separate, independent body made up of scholars that can give museums advice on whether they should be restituted, and it's up to the museum whether they take that advice or not.
In the nick of time, Mr. Vasey.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, I take it all back, Ed. That was fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. To be honest, it sounds like you're in quite a busy place and some other stuff might be going down. Shall we leave you to it?
I was on a main road. Yeah. I went down a side road. Then two lads walked up shouting and screaming. Looked like they might have their own personal issues going on. It's all go, but the dog story is true.
Okay, I want a picture on a social media platform of those three molars, and I want it by 4 o'clock. Thank you very much, Ed. It does sound like a very busy afternoon. Hope the dog's okay. Lovely to talk to you. That was our miniature piece on whether or not the Rosetta Stone should be returned to Egypt.
And it was very apt to have the countdown music because scratching around in my head, what is the best adjective to use to describe our next guest? Well, lexicographer extraordinaire might fit. She would know the most perfect descriptor because the currency that she works in is words. It's, of course, Susie Dent, who reigned in Countdown's Dictionary Corner for 30 years and still does. If you need a name for someone who loves reading in bed, clarity on why you've heard teenagers declaring they're going gym, or why we no longer say literally to mean when we are being literal, Susie has written a book of the words we need for life. And right now, we're around the time of year where the dictionaries publish their word of the year. So far, they've been a bit miserable. We've learned about parasocial relationships when you think you're close to someone that you only know online or because they're famous. And rage bait, content online that's designed to make you angry. Well, I asked Susie what her word of the year would be.
Do you know what? Every New Year's Eve, I pitch a really hopeful word because I think I just, please let it be the year for this one. And it's one of the lost positives in the dictionary, which like a mayfly disappeared after about a day. And it's respair, which is fresh hope and a recovery from despair. And I think it's such a gorgeous word. Sadly, I don't think it applies to this one, but I'm really hoping, you know, for the future. What else? Do you know what I quite like? I think one of the dictionary publishers, now all teachers will hate me for this, but I find 6-7 quite fascinating. So you know about 6-7? Yes, he's looking at me as if like, do you hear this regularly?
Yes. No. Thankfully, my kids are too old to be involved in it.
And the Prime Minister unfortunately got acquainted with 6-7 trapped
but
by a school child.
It is so massive, isn't it?
It is. And what happened?
He went to a classroom, yes, and they were opening a book and obviously inevitably landed on page 6 or 7. No. And everyone started doing the 6-7 dance, including the Prime Minister.
Oh.
And the teacher said on the way out, that's actually banned, you know.
Yes, it is banned from some schools. I mean, sometimes there are attempts to ban, you know, certain sort of slang words, etc. And I kind of understand the the reason for it, because presumably it is quite disruptive, 6-7 all the time. However, it's really difficult to police language. I mean, it's almost impossible. And English doesn't have an authority whereby, you know, there is an academy saying you can use this word or you can't use this word. In France, they do try, but it's fairly impossible. They don't want any English words coming into the language and, you know, that they're everywhere. So it's really, really difficult. The reason I find it interesting, albeit probably very annoying for a lot of people, is that no one seems to quite know what it means. I think it's drifted into the sort of, you know, so-so idea. But actually, another reason I think it is quite fun is that kids get so excited about talking about these sort of things. And the one before was skibbity, I think, which again, nobody seemed to know what it meant. And it's the kind of hybrid of the offline-online world where something online then quickly gets to be spoken offline. So for all that it's really irritating, I'm sure, I just find it quite interesting as a lexicographer to look at this one.
Yeah, very difficult to police a primary school classroom's yes. language as well. I mentioned the Prime Minister got in trouble. Very occasionally, Susie, you sort of lean into what's happening in the political world and will publish on social media a word of the day. The other day it was quokka-wodger, I hope I'm saying that right, a 19th century word, a puppet politician whose strings are pulled entirely by someone else.
Yes.
How carefully do you deploy those words when you choose to pick them?
Do you know, yes, sometimes, of course, they're sort of inspired by something that I've read or seen. Quite often, though, they are also fairly self-referential. So, you know, that there was one, I think, that I just encouraged lots of people to apply it to various politicians, but honestly, it was all about me. It was the Scots word Hingham Tringham, which was barely presentable and just about hanging together, which is how I felt that day. But my timeline was suddenly full of pictures of different people, and that is the joy of languages. You can take a word and think, I know that who that applies to, or I know who I'm going to use that of. Sadly, it's often insults, but there, you know, there are some compliments in the dictionary too. But yeah, that is I guess what I hope people will do, is pick it up and run with it, because it's fairly useful, arguably, of quite a few, you know, people. Having said that, I do think if you look at the historical thesaurus, which is a lot more fun than you would think, you can see epithets for politicians or people in public office, and they do tend to be really negative. And we do seem in language also to have a negative bias. We rarely grasp for the positive when we could actually, you know, just do away with, I don't know, I've been on a mission to replace lost, to bring back the lost positives, which are words like couth or gruntled or ruthful instead of ruthless or feckful, etc. They've just all disappeared.
I love that. We talk about that quite a lot in the podcast.
Do.
Well, things like nobody ever says that somebody's kempt, but no. We would call them unkempt.
But you can say kempt.
Yeah, but nobody does.
Nobody does. I'm definitely not kempt this morning, and nor am I shevelled. Shevelled doesn't exist yet, sadly. But, yeah, kempt is from the German gekempt, meaning well-combed, which, as you can see, I'm not. But, yes, there are so many of them there. I love gormful, you know, to be full of gorm as opposed to gormless, because gormless is quite mean, isn't it?
It is.
And feckful, full of effect, as I say, and ept, it can be a persona grata. All of these can't yet be recombobulated, but I think it's only a matter of time.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. It would be good to be recombobulated, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. This book you've written is just a complete fascinating tome of so many different words apt for each day of the year. As we head in this season of Advent, one of your December words is a binfluencer. Introduce us to yours, please.
Yes. So, yes, if I did have the choice to choose words of the year, I would give credit to whomever created this one, because this describes the neighbour who religiously puts their bin out quite early and is always the first, and everyone else follows like lemmings. They also know which bin to put out, which is quite a challenge. And yeah, they are a binfluencer.
Are you the binfluencer on your street?
Sadly not, no. Yes. That's someone called Jim.
Well done, Jim.
Very Merry Christmas to you, Jim.
Binfluencer is definitely in the sort of more slang version, isn't it,
of
words of that we're using. And we were talking a little earlier about some of the slang that maybe we're not wanting to welcome. Fee, you were saying your son often just opts out words now in sentences.
Well, there's quite a thing to say, I'm going town. Exactly.
I'm going to school.
Yeah, I'm going club. I'm going library. Not used often enough, actually. Where's that influence come from?
I generally don't know. The preposition has just dropped completely, and I've been noticing exactly the same thing. You will also find, I'm not sure if this one is drifting away, but a couple of years ago they would say, why are you fiddling with the Wi-Fi? Because internet. Because there was no of. So because was also losing it. And that seemed to be the first that I really noticed.
Do you think it is to do with texting, where so much has dropped out, including most vowels, and you just, and certainly all punctuation? My kids told me off for using aggressive punctuation in texts.
Well, that's so interesting.
Yeah,
I was actually, I for some reason was accused of saying that full stops were aggressive, which I absolutely have never said. But what I had said, I think to Stephen Fry at a book festival, is that I could just about, having thought about it, understand why younger generations are saying full stops are aggressive in certain contexts. So if you were to send a WhatsApp message to someone saying, I'm going on holiday to wherever, to Barbados, you could get that's great with an exclamation mark. That's probably the one you want. You could get a that's great with no punctuation at all. If you got a that's great full stop, that would possibly could read passive aggressive. And my teenagers definitely read it that way, whether or not it's right or wrong. I mean, clearly we need full stops. I'm not saying we don't need them, but punctuation is as subject to evolution as anything else, really. And I guess that's part of it, whether we love it or not.
I've definitely been in the habit of rereading an email and then removing some exclamation marks because I've put too many in to try and look sort of appeasing rather than just saying straightforwardly what I like. But the other habit I've noticed a lot recently, actually amongst my generation, is people referring to objects as people. So they'll say with an outfit, oh, she's nice. And you think that's, or talking about a bag or a, new piece of makeup, which feels bizarre.
That's very interesting.
Yes.
Oh, I'm learning something. Well, I've not heard that.
You may now, but it really makes me feel a bit unwell. And I feel a bit like, oh, I'm my dad's generation when he gets really cross when, I've got three younger sisters and less and fewer, I have to say, can be used interchangeably to his fury. Part of this is just reality, isn't it? We have habits and trends and things that change. What are the rules that we need to absolutely stand firm and cling on to?
Well, just be concise, be clear, and be articulate and as beautiful as you can. Be as nuanced as you can with your vocabulary, because I think that makes such a difference. And there's a lot of evidence now that choosing the right word can actually have profound benefits for our mind. So choosing positive words rather than negative ones, you can reframe your brain and the way that you think. If you have a good EQ or emotional quotient as well as an IQ, you can choose the right vocabulary to describe how you feel. And research is showing that you hit the bottle less, you go to the doctor less, you live longer. So there are quite astounding benefits. Also to swearing, famously now, having a good swear, usually privately, not aggressively at someone else. But that has distinct physiological benefits. It lowers your cortisol levels and it raises your serotonin levels. So language is so important. When it comes to hard and fast grammatical rules, English, famously, I suppose, doesn't really have that many that work universally. It's very gnarly and it is slightly chaotic, which is why I love it, because so many influences have come to bear on it. But the I before E, except after C rule, I think it was an episode of QI that calculated, almost 100 exceptions. So one dictionary publisher has come up with this ridiculous mnemonic to capture all the exceptions. So it's really hard to find rules that you can pass on to non-native speakers or to learners. I suppose we are immersed in ones that we don't know we know, like the order of adjectives or, the sounds of words and where to kind of put stress, etc. But I find English delightful from that point of view, but it's really hard to learn and to teach.
I'm not going to ask you your favourite swear word of the year, although it is tempting because we wouldn't be able to broadcast it anyway. But the final thing, the Times has been running a campaign to try and get people reading, because actually individuals across all age groups are far more likely to read on social media than in any other format. Because actually a love of words comes from learning new ones, doesn't it?
Yes.
And if all of our reading is happening online in the social media drivel or the AI slop, another word of the year
That's
where the problem starts, isn't it? Lack of reading, lack of love for reading.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of evidence now that the separation between children who are exposed to a lot of vocabulary through reading and through listening and through talking at dinner, the dinner table, etc., and those who don't have that benefit, that actually the gap is getting wider and wider. So we definitely do need to address that, and reading is just the best way in. And I think... what you tend to find is that once you can actually convince a child or an adult actually to pick up a book and start reading, then the infection is already there and it becomes a joy. It's just that hurdle, isn't it? It is just actually getting someone to open a book and sort of stick with it, because famously attention spans, thanks to social media, are much reduced now.
Just on that point, I wonder whether things will change as the younger generation becomes the generation in charge of publishing and writing or whatever, because something quite weird happens between children's books and adult books, where the length of a book, an adult book, becomes huge by comparison.
Yeah.
I think daunting by comparison.
Very true.
And if we accept that we have children with slightly diminished attention spans, isn't one thing we could do to actually play to that and just commission shorter books? Your book is the perfect length.
Thank you. It's a word of the day, so it can actually sit in your loo.
Yeah. But it's kind of moving with the times that we need
that's
to do,
really,
don't
really
we?
That's a really good point. And actually, that's where social media can probably help as well. So book talk is huge. And actually, serialisation, you know, some of the greatest novels like Dickens famously were serialised. So we could go back to that, even on social media, so that kids are really, really looking forward to the next instalment as much as they're looking forward to the next episode of whatever they're watching. I think there is definitely something to be done there. And short stories, novellas, are amazing. I picked up Raymond Carver's short stories the other day. I have not done that for ages, and it's such an art form. So, yeah, I think that's a very good point.
Mm. Very happy Christmas to you. Enjoy
you.
All of your words at Christmas.
Yeah, I will.
In fact, Christmas gives us lovely words, doesn't it?
It does.
A luxurious variety of them.
It does. Some of them from old dialect, which is wonderful. So will you be scurry funging, Fee?
Well, I try not to do it in public anymore. But when I find a quiet moment, yes, of course I will. I don't know what that is, Susie.
Oh, it's so useful. So scurry funging is essentially madly dashing around the house in an attempt to tidy up just before visitors arrive.
And how wonderful
stuff under
to say you don't do it anymore, Fee. How excellent and grown up of you.
I am such a scurry funger, I have to say.
I think we all are, aren't we? That was such a pleasure. Susie Dent, who has written Words for Life. The word for today, the 4th of December, is furhoodled, because Susie says English lacks a word to succinctly convey the sticky mess of uncooperative sellotape that can ensue whilst wrapping presents. So there we go. Furhoodled it is. Now, the Sunday Times has launched a Get Britain Reading campaign. The new campaign, which is backed by a host of stellar authors, Ian McEwan, Marion Keyes, encourages people, you and I, to take a pledge to read for 10 minutes every day. That's 10 minutes for pleasure. So that could be reading the Times app, or it could be reading your favourite novel. To find out more, go to thetimes.com/ Get Britain Reading Pledge.
So the Wix competition announcement will happen in just a couple of minutes' time. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast with Visit Scotland. Discover Times Radio's essential weekend briefing, where intelligent conversation meets incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald on Times Radio Breakfast. Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 with Visit Scotland. Start your story in Scotland with visitscotland.com/winter.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter, Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives, Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
So we have been asking for your proudest moment of the week, which gives you a chance to win a £250 Wix voucher as part of our Wix Peacock Awards. Thank you so much for all of your entries. We have had a lot, and I'm delighted to say that out of all of them, we are going to pick Lauren, who was nominated by her mum, Paula. So Paula wrote this: "Good afternoon, ladies. I would like to nominate my daughter, Lauren, who lives with her husband and three teenage stepchildren in a small two-bedroom flat. Lauren has embraced these three unconditionally over the last 5 years, giving up her bedroom for the two boys, meaning that she sleeps in the lounge. She's been so creative with making the small space work, from shoe storage to laundry solutions, prioritising their needs over her own. I couldn't be more proud or prouder of the selfless, kindest, funniest human she's become. She would love to be able to move the tumble dryer out of her bedroom lounge and into the kitchen, and she deserves to win vicariously through me. Thank you for choosing me and for your fabulous show. You've been with me through thick and thin." Well, Bian, no doubt you don't have to add a nice bit at the end. We will take it exactly as you tell it. So congratulations to Lauren, and we will be in touch, Paula, to get your details, and those Wix vouchers will be on their way to you soon. Now, don't be disappointed if you didn't win the competition, because there is going to be a chance every week between now and Christmas, every Thursday, to win a £250 Wix voucher. All you have to do is send us your proudest moment of the week. And from here on in, it doesn't just have to be about DIY. So tell us about something proud. Tell us about someone who has made you proud. And you can send it to us on WhatsApp, which is 0003 003 2353. Or you can email us, janeandfee@times.radio.
The Wix Peacock Awards on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms. Wix local design experts are ready to help. Whether you start with an in-store design consultation or a free home measure, it's completely up to you. Find out more about the free design service at wix.co.uk.
We've had a quick WhatsApp in from someone saying, "Oh my goodness, I'm scurry fundering right now for the imminent arrival of my friend tomorrow. Her house is always spotless. She has staff, I don't."
Oh, I love Times Radio listeners. It's an insight into a completely different world. How many staff does she have? And that must be annoying.
I am sure it is. Lots of other messages coming in. Lucinda says emojis are useful to show you're not being passive aggressive. Yes, they are. Colin has exclaimed, "I use too many exclamation marks." It's tricky. I think WhatsApp dynamics, particularly in family WhatsApp groups, need to be steered quite carefully to make sure you don't upset or cause any hurt feelings. We had one particular incident in the Wright family where granddad left the group, where my dad changed the photograph of the family WhatsApp to a picture of a skip because my aunt had been doing some household work, and my granddad had inferred that my dad was saying the group was a pile of rubbish. And once you get the message saying granddad's left the group, it's quite hard to facilitate a climb down from there, which unfortunately we didn't manage. That gives you an insight into how you should be careful with what you do and say and the exclamations you use on WhatsApp. That is
I love
it
hearing stories from your world, Rosie. I just love it. Rosie is back next Wednesday and Thursday, and Monday and Tuesday I'll be presenting the afternoon show with Roy and Nika. So I hope that we can count on your company all the way through next week.
Absolutely. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, though, don't go anywhere. From 4 o'clock, it is John Pienaar, of course, with Drive.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Roya. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The family of Dawn Sturgis, who died in the aftermath of the Salisbury poisonings, criticises a report into her death. And the UK has signed a defence pact with Norway to run a combined fleet to hunt down Russian submarines. And coming up, the lethal threat from Putin's Russia is clear, both in today's report, in the poisonings of Dawn Sturgis and the Skripals here on British soil, and in the continuing war in Ukraine. Russia sees a fight against all of NATO. We're going to be looking at how the EU and the UK hope to fight back by freezing Russian assets and using them for Ukraine. We'll discuss the intelligence picture here and across Europe and how the fight back is affecting the Swedish church.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news here on Times Radio.
Good afternoon, I'm Tom Noonan. The Foreign Secretary says Vladimir Putin is an active threat to British citizens after a report found him morally responsible for the death of a British woman after the Salisbury poisonings. Yvette Cooper insists the UK is going further than before by sanctioning Russia's GRU spy agency in response to the inquiry into Dawn Sturgis's death.
Sanctioning these individuals and their organisation brings them out of the shadows. It's a message to British companies and organisations that operate across the world that they should have no dealings with the GRU or with any of these individuals who we bring out of the shadows.
Dawn Sturgis's family have criticised the report. She died in 2018 after spraying herself with the nerve agent Novichok, which had been discarded by Russian agents trying to kill former spy Sergei Skripal. Her family say they have real concern. There are not public recommendations from the report, but the inquiry chair, Lord Hughes, says no medical care could have saved Ms. Sturgis's life and failings by British authorities did not directly lead to her death.
I am sure that in conducting this attack on Sergei Skripal, they must have been acting on instructions received from their superiors. And I've concluded that the operation to assassinate Sergei Skripal must have been authorised at the highest level, indeed by President Putin.
The UK has signed a defence pact with Norway to run a combined fleet to hunt down Russian submarines. The government says it's aimed at protecting undersea cables in the North Sea. A man's been charged with terrorism offences linked to the man who attacked Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. 31-year-old Mohammed Bashir is facing four charges after being accused of helping Jihad al-Shami with early reconnaissance of a defence facility. Al-Shami was killed by police when he attacked the synagogue in October. A major incident has been declared in Derby. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of explosives offences and more than 200 homes have been evacuated as a precaution. Nigel Farage has demanded an apology from the BBC for its historical output when questioned about allegations of racism as a schoolboy. The Reform UK leader criticised the BBC and ITV for their questions at a press conference.
Until you apologise for all of your output, your appalling output, at the same time that I'm accused of saying these things which I deny, I'm not speaking to you. All right? Very good. Harry, you are wasting your time. Bernard Manning. Do you want to hear some of the Bernard Manning jokes on ITV?
Mr. Farage was giving a press conference about the government's decision to delay four mayoral elections, which he calls monstrous. Labour insists there needs to be work done to set up the new mayor's offices. And in cricket, England opener Zach Crawley says Joe Root is humble as ever after the Yorkshireman got his first test century in Australia. Root's 135 not out helped England to 325 for nine on day one of the second Ashes test. It means he'll go out to bat tomorrow with Jofra Archer as England try to level the series. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio,
on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Does anyone still need to be convinced of the lethal threat from Vladimir Putin's Russia and the need to raise our guard higher, to do more, to spend more? Really, if you do, tell me why. And that's not a rhetorical question then. You know the text, 97222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio, tell me what you think. And just look at today's report that Putin was personally responsible for ordering the famous poisoning of the Russian defector Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia at their home in Salisbury by Russian agents, and the fact that the killers mocked Britain afterwards. I'll have more on that report later on in the programme, and on MI5's failures to protect them. And coming up, the Foreign Office has announced Britain is proscribing Russia's GRU security agencies. Its office has murdered the Skripals. Well, maybe that it hadn't happened already, but still. I'm going to be talking live to an expert on Russia's spying and global murder. Meanwhile, some good news on the effort by Ukraine's friends to help the country maintain its desperate resistance to the Russian invasion. The EU has moved closer to providing around 90 billion euros, enough to cover two-thirds of Ukraine's needs for 2 years. The UK is throwing some 8 billion euros using frozen Russian assets into the same pot. This is game-changing money, and I'm going to be finding out what difference it could make. I should probably add that when I mention Ukraine's friends and supporters, well, can I really include the United States and President Trump in that list? Donald Trump told the world that this week's US-Russia talks were reasonably good, though they had achieved nothing. He said Vladimir Putin would like to end the war, which may be true, so long as the war ends in defeat for Ukraine, which he refuses to recognise as a country. Still, Ukrainian envoys are talking to President Trump's envoys in the USA later, and we'll be watching for news from Miami. And by the way, speaking of the Trump administration, what do you make of the news that a startup company backed by Donald Trump's son, Don Trump Jr., has just been given a $620 million funding deal by President Trump's Department of War, as it has been renamed by President Trump, which is obviously good news for someone. I wonder what you think. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. First, though, let's talk about the European Commission introducing a proposal to use EU powers to seize frozen Russian assets to fund a reparations loan for Ukraine. It's worth 90 billion euros. Now, this was set out to prevent 210 billion in assets held in banks and clearinghouses under sanctions measures. We can talk to Tom Keating from RUSI in Brussels for us for the conference taking place now on frozen assets. Hello to you, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good of you to join us, Tom. So this latest iteration of the plan, is this one going to go through?
Well, we're waiting for Godot, aren't we? I mean, I think we can safely say that the EU tries every possible plan until it finally finds one at the 11th hour. I mean, I think the EU is zooming in on a solution, and that solution is based on breaking the traditional unanimity that's needed in order to decide and agree ideas in the European Union. That's been the big blocker on all of this.
Yes.
Holdouts.
And when we talk about the blockages, in member state terms, we're talking about Belgium, aren't we, which had legal worries about this. And, of course, in the background, you've got others like Hungary, like Slovakia, Bulgaria, which in many ways are more sympathetic to Russia with reservations about an idea like this.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So I think it's important to differentiate those who traditionally gripe about any action taken against Russia. So chiefly Hungary, but yes, those lining up behind Hungary. And then Belgium, and Belgium in particular, because the majority of Russia's frozen assets are held at a bank called Euroclear.